Thanks. So I like to use this picture at the beginning of my talks because it reminds me of what are the great things about being a scientist? So one of the great things about being a scientist is that you keep on learning things and things that are exciting. Another great thing about being a scientist is that you get to spend time with people who are smart and also like to think, and then you get this great company when you come to meetings. And then the other third great thing about being a scientist is that you go to meetings in these beautiful places, like Santa Barbara. And this is another beautiful place where I've gone to a meeting, which was Santorini, and it was a fantastic place to take great pictures. So I like to use it when I start. So the work that I'm going to talk about today, so what I want to tell you about today is, since our topic is about emerging techniques, and mostly we have talked about emerging techniques from the experimental point of view, like these very exciting developments in optogenetics and our ability to record and influence neural activity in many different ways, I also wanted to tell you a little bit about emerging techniques from the theoretical point of view. And this is not totally new. This is a technique that has been around in analyzing multi-neuron activity for about 4 to 5 years. And it's the idea of using generalized linear models. And since nobody has talked about generalized linear models in this meeting, I thought I would start by giving you a little overview, mini review of what generalized models are and how to use them. And that will be the first part of my talk. And in the second part of my talk, I'll tell you about an experiment done at Northwestern University in the lab of my colleague Lee Miller by a student that just graduated, Jim Rebesco, where he actually did an STDP-like paradigm for inducing changes in a small network of neurons of an in vivo animal, of a rat. And we use generalized linear models to monitor the effective connectivity between among this small number of neurons that we're recording from. And we use the generalized linear model to monitor the changes, to monitor the plastic changes, and verify that we were indeed able to restructure the network and to change the activity within that network. And the interesting thing about doing it using generalized linear models is that because these models are based on the statistics of the firing activity of all the neurons that you're recording from, the way in which you monitor the synaptic change is not by looking at how the postsynaptic neuron changes its response to an input or to a particular pattern of stimulation, but actually by monitoring a network that is affecting the behavior of the animal and seeing how this network is changing its statistical pattern of firing. And actually, the animal was not being asked to do anything. The rat was just running around, and still we were able to monitor changes in this network, which is, I think, the interesting property of these kind of models. So these ideas about inferring functional connectivity or inferring the connectivity of the underlying network arose in area of being able to record from high-density multi-electrode arrays. So this is typical arrays that are implanted in monkeys. They are 10 by 10, so it's 100 electrodes. This is about 3 to 4 millimeters, so the separation between electrodes is about 400 microns. And you implant them by just opening the dura and opening the cranium and just puffing them in. It's a little bit like a staple gun for putting carpets in your floor, you know, just go poof, and this goes in. And it typically reaches to layer 3, although over time it sinks a little bit, and it's possible that then one is recording to deeper layers, 4 or 5. So one can record simultaneously from many neurons. These are, of course, extracellular recordings, and by doing spike sorting, one can extract from that single neuron activity, and it is possible to record simultaneously from the order of 100 neurons, which is, of course, very small when you think of an electrode like this being implanted in motor cortex or premotor cortex of a monkey, where there are millions of neurons that are simultaneously participating in a task or being modulated by a task. But it is a lot, of course, compared to single electrode recordings. So this is just a raster plot that shows every horizontal line corresponds to a different neuron. This is about 20 seconds of recording, and this in particular was a recording in primary motor cortex while the monkey was executing a very simple tracking task. So this was implanted in the arm area of primary motor cortex. So obviously this is not only being triggered by the activity that the monkey is being asked to do, just tracking this target, but it's also being modulated by the connectivity and the interaction among these neurons. And actually, have done a lot of work in trying to understand the code from the point of view of doing nonlinear dimensionality reduction on this kind of activity and trying to follow this activity on manifolds that really need to be described as manifolds. They are not subspaces, so one needs to do nonlinear dimensionality reduction. But in any case, that's not what I want to talk about today. I want to give you, as I said, a quick tour of generalized linear models and show you how they can be applied to try to extract from these kind of simultaneous recordings some information about the underlying structure of the network. What is the cooperative behavior among of these neurons that we are recording simultaneously? So this is the theoretical setup. It's very similar to a point process type description. So we consider a population of n neurons. We observe the spiking activity simultaneously during this time interval from 0 to capital T. We divide the interval into bins of size delta equals T over K. K is the number of bins, and we use lowercase k to label the bins from 1 to K. So at each time interval, we can observe the number of spikes y sub I of K, which are emitted by neuron I in that time interval K, and we can do that for all the neurons in the population. So it's important that this binning that I'm talking about doesn't have to be so small that the number of spikes in each bin is either 0 or 1, which is the usual setup in point process models. Here we can actually allow for Poisson statistics. For instance, if this is neuron 1, neuron 2, neuron n that you're recording, and this is the binning, this will be your variable y sub n of k. It will just count 3, 2, 1, 0, 0, and so on, counting the actual number of spikes that that neuron emitted in that particular time interval. And it will be a non-negative integer, 0, 1, 2, 3. It's a Poisson variable, but it doesn't have to be a binary variable. So we talk then about these time intervals that go from tk minus 1 to tk, and they are k such bins of size delta equals t over k, and we measure y sub I of k. This is the data. This is the number of spikes emitted by neuron I at that particular time interval. And they do so with a probability, p of y sub I of k. So our data consists then, you know, so I get these rasters from the experimentalists, I do the binning, and my data consists of knowing for every neuron and for every time interval what was the number of spikes emitted in that time interval by that neuron. And the simplest model that we can think of is to assume that the spiking activity of neuron I in that time interval is actually modeled by a Poisson process whose parameter lambda, whose mean is lambda sub I of k. And then if that's the case, then we know how to write down the probability of having observed exactly that number of spikes, y sub I of k, emitted by neuron I at time interval k. The probability of y sub I of k, given the parameter lambda, is going to be lambda to the y, e to the minus lambda, divided by y factorial. So it's just a simple Poisson model for that stochastic variable. But of course, I cannot write down the model unless I have some idea of what this lambda should be. But if I know what lambda is, then I can compute the probability of the observed number of spikes at that time and at that interval. Yeah. I'm going to go into a maximum likelihood model, actually. That's exactly what I'm going to do next. Yeah. So I can say if I had been given these parameters, lambda sub I of k, if I knew what is the Poisson parameter for every neuron at every time interval, then I could write down what is the probability of the observed data. Because, of course, what every neuron does is conditionally independent once I know what the lambda sub I of k is. So any time correlations or any space correlations among the neurons would be contained on correlations among these parameters, but conditioned on the parameters, then the firing activity of every neuron in every time interval is an independent variable. You look very puzzled, Fred. Oh, okay. So then, of course, because this is an independent variable, I can factorize these probabilities, factorize them over space, that is to say over the neurons that I'm recording from, and factorize it over time. So this product of the observed ensemble activity over time and over neurons can be written in as this double product of the lambda to the y, e to the minus lambda divided by y factorial, indexed in every case by the neuron label I and by the time label k. And we define the likelihood of this as the logarithm of the probability, so the log of the product becomes the sum of the logs. And this is the structure of the likelihood function. And I want you to pay attention to the structure of this, because this is going to be a very important, play important role in what we do afterwards. So here is the data. Y sub I of k is the observed data. It appears here, and it appears here. And here is the parameter, lambda. It appears linearly, and then the log of lambda appears linearly coupled to the data. And that's going to make our life very easy when we try to solve this problem. So if I know the data, what I would like to do is a maximum likelihood parametric search to find the parameters lambda I of k that maximize L sub t. And here I have dropped the term that comes from the factorial, because that term does not depend on lambda. So there is an extra dependence on the data, which is the logarithm of y sub k factorial. But if I'm going to ask myself, given the data, how do I search over the lambda space in order to maximize this likelihood, then of course I don't need that extra term. So far so good, but then the question is, am I going to search for the lambdas, or am I going to now incorporate some more? So far, everything I've done is just a maximum likelihood, and all I've done is to assume that the signals are Poisson and they are conditionally independent if I knew, given condition upon knowing the Poisson parameter for every neuron for every time. Raul, you had a question? By maximizing the likelihood? You could say that the Poisson assumption maximizes the entropy if I assume that the only parameter that I know is the lambda sub I of k. Right? So by making this Poisson assumption, I could have said, if I only knew what is the expected value of y sub I of k, and that's lambda sub I of k, then the Poisson distribution is a maximal entropy distribution, if that's all I know about the firing of the neurons, and the y sub I's are integer non-negative variables. Then it is a maximum likelihood, it's a maximal entropy assumption in the statistics. Because I'm assuming that all correlations are going to come in correlations in the lambdas, but that the y's are conditionally independent given the lambdas, right? Then it's a... Say it again, Carl?
It's also the
right, exactly. So, and this conditional independence assumption is more also for any kind of higher order correlations beyond the mean. So now this is where the generalized linear model appears. The generalized linear model is a model for the log of lambda sub I. And I will, it will take the next 10, 15 minutes to explain to you why I need to take a log there. And that's what I want to show you essentially. So the log of lambda sub I is modeled as a linear combination of the observed variables. Now, if I'm looking at time k, the observed variables have been the activity of all the other neurons up to that time, but not including that time. So I'm asking, by knowing everything that the network has done up to t minus 1 or k minus 1, the preceding time being, can I gather from that information, or can I make a prediction about what is this expectation value for the firing of neuron I at time k? So log of lambda I of k is expressed as a linear combination. There's an alpha I zero, and there are parameters alpha ij of m that tell me how the firing of neuron j m time beings ago are going to affect the expected value of the firing of neuron I at time k. And so these alpha ij of m's are kernels that are used to convolve with the past activity of neuron J to determine what is the effect of neuron J on neuron I. So they are playing the role of a time-dependent connectivity parameter. Sophie? Okay, so this is some kind of linear nonlinear model, right? Because here is a linear combination and here is the nonlinearity. But I'm going to justify why I'm proposing that nonlinearity. I'm going to show you that it's not an arbitrary nonlinearity, and I'm going to show you where this assumption of a linear combination comes from. So this is essentially the generalized linear model for this class of problems, but I'm going to show you why. I mean, you've seen it in papers. It has been applied, by by Chichilinsky, by Pillow et al. To the Chichilinsky data on retinal ganglion cells. It has been applied by the Donahue group in Brown to multi-electrode recordings of electrodes of the type I showed you before in monkeys, and more recently, actually, even in humans. They have a very interesting clinical trial with quadriplegic patients. I think we have 6 patients in the clinical trial where they have actually implanted these 10 by 10 electrode arrays in primary motor cortex of human subjects, and they record while the human subjects do a very simple reaching task, and they are trying to read the code very much in the way that we've been doing for monkeys. So, okay, so let me accept for a moment that this will be the model, and as I said, the next 10, 15 minutes will be devoted to explaining you why, where this model or where this proposal comes from. And so essentially, if the log of lambda is this linear combination, then this log of lambda becomes a linear combination that is coupled to y, and then the lambda is e to the linear combination. And now I can write the likelihood of the data in terms not of lambda, because lambda has been modeled for this parameter alpha, but I can write it as condition on the parameters alpha, and I can use the same maximum likelihood thought, and I can ask myself, given the data, can I find the parameters alpha that maximize the likelihood? So can I do a maximum likelihood estimation of these parameters? And if I can, then I want to convince you that in some sense I'm solving the problem of estimating connectivity, because these kernels are telling me exactly the effect that neuron J has on neuron I, but looking past, looking into the time, looking. Say it again. Oh, I'm going to talk about that as time comes. No, I do not mean anatomic synapses. But let me say something about that right now. So people have proposed methods, other methods for network reconstruction based on Granger causality and things of that type. And typically, so you read these papers where people explain the method, then they create an artificial network that has 10 neurons in which the ground truth is known, because you know how you connected these neurons in your model. They use the model to generate spikes, and then they go back to their method, they apply the method to the spikes, and they reconstruct the network. And they show you some degree of success, let's say between 60 and 90% in reconstructing the ground truth, in having recovered the interactions that were there in the model that you used to simulate the data. But in this scenario, you are monitoring all the degrees of freedom in the network. You assume that the network had 10 neurons, you are monitoring all 10 neurons, and you're trying to reconstruct the interactions among those 10 neurons. When we do multi-electrode recordings, we're monitoring 100 neurons among a population of 1 million neurons. So there are many interactions among these neurons that are being mediated for other neurons by other neurons that we are not monitoring at all. So when I recover, quote unquote, the network among those 10 neurons or 100 neurons that I'm recording, this can never be the actual connectivity. This is an effective connectivity. This is the way these neurons would have to be connected if they were alone in the world in order to reproduce the spiking statistics that I have observed. So the question of ground truth in network reconstruction is moot when your networks are embedded in a much larger network, when your neurons are embedded in a much larger network that you're not monitoring. So that was a long answer, but the short answer is no. You cannot recover the ground truth, but not by this method, by no method, if you are subsampling in this extreme limit in which you're monitoring 100 neurons out of 1 million. But I'll show you how, I'll give you some quantitative data of that that we got from a simulation environment. Yeah? What do you mean by shorter timescales? Yeah. Right, but you could incorporate in this model any covert. Let me go back a little bit further on justifying this model, and then I will tell you other things that if you know about them, essentially you can incorporate in this model anything that you can measure. Now, I don't know how you can measure attention, but if you know, for instance, that this area is being influenced by some other area, and you have information about the activity of that other area, that's another covariate that will allow you to explain or that should influence lambda sub I of k, and then you can incorporate it in the model. Let me move a little bit forward, and I'll show you how to do that. Any other questions? Okay, so this is the model. We wrote down a model like this. Lambda sub I was the time-dependent mean of a Poisson process. And in this class of models called generalized linear models, we take a nonlinear function of lambda sub I, which is called the link function, which in this case is the logarithm. And this nonlinear function of this observed mean is written as a linear combination of all the observed variables. And then, of course, given this model, you compute the likelihood of all the observed activity, in this case, spiking activity, that can be then written in terms of these various kernels, and then you can find the maximum likelihood kernels. But the question is, why do we write a model of this type? So there are two things to justify, this linear combination and then nonlinear function. I'm going to show you that the fact that this nonlinear function has to be a log is a direct consequence of having made an hypothesis of Poisson statistics. It cannot be anything else, and I'll show you that. And then the idea of a linear combination here is the idea of the generalized linear model. And the idea is that you can make a linear combination of any variables that you think will allow you to predict or will give you information about this lambda sub I of k. So for instance, I could believe that the product of two activities is going to be influential, that there will be something like the three-point interaction that Elad Shneinman was discussing some weeks ago. And then I would have to have an alpha ij k of m and m prime multiplying the y sub j of k minus m and a y sub k of k minus m prime. I guess k was not such a good notation. And I can do that. This has to be linear in the parameters. It doesn't have to be linear in the variables that I observe. That's another very common misconception about generalized linear models, that this has to be linear in the observed variables. It has to be a linear combination of anything that you believe that, first of all, you can compute from your observed data, and second, that you believe has some influence of lambda I of k. I guess the temperature in Santa Barbara would not, but okay, so then the alphas would be zero once you try to solve the problem, hopefully. So, but for instance, if you know the kind of things that Theo was suggesting, if you know something about the state of the animal, the state of attention, anything that you can measure, so this is a linear combination of data, of observables. I can certainly incorporate it in this linear, know the activity, as I said, of other areas that project onto this. If I know what the input is, what the stimulus is, I can also add it with a kernel. If I know what the animal is doing in terms of motor output, I can also add it with a kernel. And if I don't know whether what matters is, for instance, in the case of motion, the position of the arm, the velocity of the arm, or where the movement is directed towards, I can put all these things, because if I can measure them, I can put them in, and then let the maximum likelihood algorithm tell me through the strength of the alphas which are the variables that really explain lambda sub I. Okay? So it's a very general kind of model, and it's a form of linear nonlinear model. But why does it have a log? So in order to explain to you why it has a log, I have to go back to something that Peter talked about, which is this exponential family of probability distributions. So this is a little bit of a rehash of the things that Peter did in the blackboard when he talked. So y is a random variable, and I'm going to talk about a family of probability distributions on y that are controlled by two parameters, delta and phi. And the distribution has to be of the form, the exponential of y times delta minus a function of delta divided by a function of phi plus another function of y and phi. So y is a random variable whose probability distribution you are trying to describe. Delta is a parameter that is called the canonical parameter in these exponential distributions, and phi is a parameter that is called the dispersion parameter. And of course, in order to specify the family, you have to say what b of delta is, what a of phi is, and what c of y and phi is. And in particular, the C of y and phi plays a very important role because it's there to guarantee normalization. So that if I take this and I integrate it over y, the integral should be y for any delta and any phi. So it should be a properly normalized distribution. Yeah. No. Y can be anything. In my model, y be a non-negative variable. But let me step away from my model for a moment and talk about exponential distributions. Because I wanted to have a Poisson variable. Because I talk to motor cortex scientists and the muscles integrate over 100 milliseconds, so the precise spike timing cannot be important. But I can discretize time within half a millisecond if you want. You tell me the precision within which you want to know.
Is a fundamental problem if you do everything with instantaneous, continuous time.
I have to think about it. Numerically, you'll discretize, but that's not the question that Rob is asking. Rob is asking, could I write down the whole theory for a continuous time process? And I have to think about it, how to do it. You can? That's the answer? No, I don't know. Let's sit. We have the whole weekend to answer this question. We'll tell you on Monday whether this can be done or not. So this is the family of exponential distributions with canonical parameter delta, dispersion parameter phi. Why should you care? How exotic is this? Well, you should care because almost all the distributions you know about and you use are actually members of this family. Normal, Bernoulli, binomial, multinomial, Poisson, gamma, geometric, chi-square, beta. One distribution that I tend to use that is not in this family is a Dirichlet distribution, but otherwise all the distributions that I use are of this family by some particular choice of B of delta, A of phi, and C of y and phi. Sophie? Yeah, this could all be multidimensional. So if y is a p-dimensional vector, delta also has to be a p-dimensional vector, and this would be the scalar product. This also has to be a p-dimensional vector. And then it depends on what you do. I mean, A of phi typically is a scalar, and C typically can be a vector also. C would be a vector of the same dimensionality, a vector function. Phi is typically a scalar, but actually, you could also think, like if you're really trying to do a multi, so phi is a variance-related parameter, I will show you in a minute. So if you really wanted to do a Gaussian, I think in the case where you have a full covariance matrix, then this would be a matrix and A would also be a matrix. So you'd be dividing by a matrix. Yeah. Say it again. That would be your C, but also your A, because phi, I'll show you in a minute that phi is a variance-like parameter. This is why people call it a dispersion parameter. Okay, so this is the only thing that you really need to know at this, for this talk about this exponential family. So we have an exponential family of this type, and we know that these functions are arbitrary, but not so arbitrary because C of y and phi has this job in life, that is that the integral over y of rho sub y has to be 1 for every value, every pair of values of delta and phi. So since it has to be 1, and since this is an exponential, and since taking derivatives with respect to delta with lower a factor of y, it's clear that on one hand, the derivative with respect to delta of this integral is 0, and the second derivative with respect to delta of this integral is also 0 because this integral is normalized. But by taking a first derivative with respect to delta, I lower a factor of y, and I will also lower a factor of b prime of delta, which will allow me to relate the expectation value of y to b prime of delta. And by taking a second derivative, and I will get the expectation value of y squared, and then by subtracting b prime of delta squared, I will be able to compute the variance, and the variance is going to be given by a of I times b double prime of delta. So note that if I know b of delta, by taking b prime of delta, I know what is the expectation value of y. So only delta contributes to the mean of this distribution, while I need to know both delta and phi to know the variance. In that sense, phi is a variance-like parameter. This is why it's called the dispersion parameter. So you need to get additional information provided by the dispersion parameter in order to compute the variance, but not to compute the mean. And actually, if you're interested in these models, there is a beautiful book by McCullough and Nelder. McCullough is still an old and very wise professor at University of Chicago, and it's a real pleasure to talk to him. And it's an old book, and it's mostly an engineering book. So, you know, this has been put forward many years ago and used for all sorts of interesting engineering applications. But here we are. So now this is great because, you know, when I first studied Poisson distributions, which are, of course, of this form, lambda to the y, e to the minus lambda divided by y factorial, I learned to do all these tricks about sums in order to show, you know, what was the mean and what was the variance and all that, right? So you know that the property, this is normalized because you pull out the e to the minus lambda and this is expansion of e to the lambda, so it's 1. And then you know that if you put an extra y here, you can begin to do tricks with the y minus 1 factorial and pull out, you know, a factor of lambda, so you get lambda to the y minus 1, so you can prove that the expectation value of y is lambda. And then you can do more manipulations to show that the variance is also like lambda. So you know how to do this from the sums. But actually, if you know that it is of this form, you don't know to do anything with the sums, because once you identify what B of delta should be, then you know that to read the expectation, you never again have to compute an expectation on a variance of a complicated function once it is of the exponential form. So I thought that was a neat trick. Okay, so we have these relationships, that the expectation value of y is going to be b prime of delta, and the variance of y is going to be b double prime of delta multiplied by a of phi. And they hold for any probability density function within this exponential family, these relationships, right? They come from the normalization of the function. But now we know that I want to show you that if you have an exponential function with this property, that the expectation has to be a parameter lambda and the variance has to be the same parameter lambda, I want to show you that you have no choice but getting Poisson statistics. So in an exponential family, if I impose this relationship that b prime of delta has to be lambda, and a of I times b double prime of lambda of delta also has to be lambda, then the only way to do that is, of course, this cannot possibly depend on phi, so a of phi has to be 1. And because the first derivative has to be a second derivative, the only way to do that is if b of delta is e to the delta, so that by taking an extra derivative, you don't change it. And that's where the logarithm is going to come from. So you have, if you want to describe a Poisson distribution in this language, you do not need the dispersion parameter, you only need the canonical parameter, and the relationship between the canonical parameter and the mean is that e to the delta is lambda. Yeah, Peter. Say it again. Can't b of delta be a constant times e to the delta? Yeah, it could be. It's just a shift in delta. It's just a shift in delta. Yeah, it could be. Yeah. This goes back to the alpha I zero that I wrote in my equation. Yeah, you can shift delta. It's true. I should. Well, the only way in which this derivative is invariant is instead of this being e to the delta is c times e to the delta, which is the same as e to the delta plus c prime, where e to the c prime is c. No, if I add a constant, then I don't satisfy, because the constant goes away the first time I take a derivative. If I write c plus e to the delta, then if the first derivative is c plus e to the delta, the second derivative doesn't have the c. It's only e to the delta. It cannot be an additive.
The first derivative is b plus c plus e to the delta.
Yeah,
b prime e to the delta.
Oh, b. Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't care. Yeah. Okay. You could do that. Sorry, I didn't understand your question properly. So if b to the delta then is e to the delta, then the canonical parameter delta is log lambda. We don't need a dispersion parameter. And now we just write it down. We say, okay, I have to write e to the y times delta. Y delta is log lambda. Then I have minus b of delta. And b of delta is exactly e to the delta, which is lambda. Then I have to divide by a of phi, but I don't have an a of phi because it's 1. And then I have a c, which is only a c of y. Then this is of this form. And then it has to be normalized, and that is what requires that c of y is related to y factorial. So this is the general form that you get for a generalized linear model. Now this is the assumption. So given the given the structure of the model, the relationship between delta and the expectation value is fixed. In this case, delta was the relationship was that e to the delta is going to be lambda, where lambda is expectation value of y. So in a generalizing model, what you do is to approximate delta, or to propose that delta should be a linear combination of all your observed variables. Linear, again, linear in the parameters. So you construct delta as a linear combination of all the observed variables that can explain this random variable y. And then you relate delta, which is your canonical parameter, to the expectation value of y through a nonlinear function. And this linear function is the link function. And in the case of a Poisson model, then the link function has to be the logarithm. In the Poisson case, delta was log lambda, so it was the log of the expectation value of y. The nonlinear link function G is the logarithm, so lambda is e to the delta, delta is the log of lambda. So this is why we write that the log of lambda at time t, given the whole history, so this h of t is a shorthand for what all the neurons have done for all times up to, but not including t, of course, because I'm trying to say something about lambda I of t, can be written as a linear combination. And again, here you could add a linear combination of any covariate that you want, motor output, if this is a sensory neuron, like a visual neuron or a retinal ganglion cell, you could add the visual stimulus. If you know how to measure the degree of attention of the animal, you could add it. It could be if you know that there has been a dopamine release in that area that you can measure, you can add it. So any covariate of lambda I can be incorporated into the model as long as you can measure it. It has to be data. And it has to be a linear combination, in a sense, linear in the parameters, but again, it can include any terms. It doesn't have to be linear in the observables, and that's very important. So these models are very general, more than other people appreciate. Okay, so this is what we have. We have now a generalized linear model for Poisson statistics. Our delta, which is the log of lambda, is written as a linear combination, so lambda is e to the alpha I zero times this. So this is essentially a particular form of linear nonlinear model. So you create a linear combination, and then you add a specific nonlinearity, which in this case it has to be the exponential. And everything is expressed in terms of this, well, background activity, and which is what I thought Peter was talking about, but he wasn't, because he wasn't about talking, okay, it doesn't matter. I thought he meant adding to delta, which would be in this parameter, but he meant something different. So, and again, these kernel parameters quantify the effect, in this case, that neuron J has on neuron I, where a spiking activity of neuron J precedes the effect on neuron I by M, where M is just the number of beans. So you go from lambda I at T, how it is affected by Y sub J at T minus M. And I'm now going to say a couple of things about how we solve this problem. So we have the likelihood of the data. The likelihood of the data was expressed in this form, in the Poisson assumption. Then it is the log of lambda that is written in this way. So now this has a rather simple form because the log of lambda that appears here multiplying the data is just this linear combination. So this term is linear in the data. This term is going to be quadratic in the data and is going to look at correlations between what neuron J was doing at time k minus m and what neuron I is doing at time k. And then you have this lambda, and here you have the nonlinearity because lambda is e to the linear combination. So this is the likelihood. Is this an easy problem and can we solve it? And the answer is yes, it's a very easy problem because this likelihood, although this looks very complicated, is actually a concave downwards function in parameter space. So it has a single maximum and you can find it by doing gradient ascent. So let me show you a very simple example. Let's assume I have a single neuron, which I call neuron one. So I don't have to sum over all the other neurons, I just have to sum over time. I have the activity of that neuron now and in the past. I have a background parameter and then an autoregressive kernel, and then the e to the that. And to make it even simpler, let's forget the autoregressive kernel for a moment, and let's look at a single parameter, which is the background activity of that neuron. So then this is what the likelihood looks like. And the important thing is that this likelihood has a linear dependence on the parameters that comes with a positive sign and an exponential dependence on the parameter that comes with a negative sign. So that's the general structure of this problem, and this is why you can always solve it. So this is the linear part, this is the exponential part, and when you sum them, you get something like this. For very strong negative values, the linear part dominates, and then the minus the exponential takes you over because you have e to the parameter, and then you always have a single maximum. So this is just to illustrate what it is, but in general, you can just write it down. And I want to write it down because this is what a modern scientist of the theoretical persuasion does, at least a younger model scientist of theoretical persuasion does, is take this problem and they say, okay, so this is the data, this is data, this is data. Alpha, 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 alpha are parameters. I have to now find the maximum of this function. So MATLAB has a routine that is called maximize or optimize, and you call your MATLAB routine and you get the values of the alphas. But it turns out that because it has a single maximum that you can find by doing gradient ascent, it's a very good idea to write down the gradient and to write down the second derivative, because then you learn a little bit about the structure of the problem that you're trying to solve, as opposed to just calling a MATLAB routine to do that. Although I was trying to convince Sophie about that for the kernel she was computing, but actually I was wrong and she was right, and I was, it was not a MATLAB problem, it was a problem that I did a theoretical derivation where I had a minus sign wrong. So in this case, the problem was not calling the MATLAB routine, it was my thinking that was upside down. Oh, nice shape like that? Yeah, we all wish that all our problems had a nice shape like that, then we wouldn't be doing complicated optimization. Okay, so let me just show you, and then I'll show you the data. So you have a gradient that drives the uphill search, and this is the form of the gradient, and this is very nice. You're computing the effect that the alpha ij of m has on this likelihood function. Remember, alpha ij of m went from neuron j to neuron, i with a lag of m. And so look at, this is the form. You sum, I and j are fixed, and you sum over all time intervals. This is the activity of what I call the presynaptic neuron, y sub j at time k minus m. And this is a difference between activities of the postsynaptic neuron, which is I. This is the actual firing activity of neuron I at time interval k. And this is your current estimation based on the current values of the parameters. So this is a very nice form. It has the form of what we call a delta rule. It has the form that in order to do error correction, you multiply presynaptic activity by postsynaptic error. And this is a rule that had been used to train neural networks. It was first proposed by Bernie Woodruff in the 70s. So it's a famous rule called the delta rule. Now, I have written presynaptic and postsynaptic here in italics because this goes back to Peter's comment. The alpha ij of m is not the synaptic coupling from neuron j to neuron I. And you know, whenever I write a paper about this, I get some irritated referee reports that say, but this is not the synaptic coupling. And I say, I never said it was the synaptic coupling, but I feel I always have to make this comment. Then you can compute the second derivative, and the second derivative also has a pretty form. So now in the second derivative, you're going to neuron I, but you're coming from neuron j and neuron j prime at different times lag m and m prime. So now you have two presynaptic activities, neuron j, m time steps ago, neuron j prime, m prime time steps ago, and those two activities now get multiplied by your current estimate of the activity of neuron I at time k. And now, all these y's are of course non-negative integers. This is not necessarily going to be an integer, but it's going to be non-negative. So everything in here is positive, and you have a big minus sign in the front. The second derivative is always negative. This function is indeed a concave downwards function, so it will have a single maximum, as in the simple example that I showed you. The surface is everywhere concave. So this is how you solve the problem. You say you have an iterative algorithm that is driven by the gradient, and you have a matrix of step sizes, and this matrix is just going to be the inverse of the Hessian. So this is a pseudo code of how you solve the problem. With your current values of the parameters, so mu and mu are your current values of the parameters, this would be what you would say now is the expectation value of y sub a of k. Once you have computed this, you can throw away the current parameters. They only appear through this. So you compute the gradient, this is data, this is data, this is where the parameters are hidden. You compute the matrix of second derivatives, where again, this is data, and this is where the parameters are hidden. You invert the Hessian to get this matrix epsilon of step sizes, and you iterate. And you are guaranteed to convert to the maximum because it is a single maximum. So this is the kind of things that you get when you actually apply this to real data. You get kernels, you get auto kernels, and you get across neuron kernels. So this is the basic idea. You are neuron A, you see your own spikes, these are your own spikes, and you see them filter through a kernel which is the alpha AA of M in this case, but you also see the neurons, the spikes emitted by neuron B filtered by another kernel which would be the alpha AB of M in this case. So the input from neuron B is filtered through this across neuron kernel, the output the preceding spike in history of neuron A is also filtered back, and this is a lot like the kind of model that Sophie was discussing when we had this afternoon meeting after her talk. So that you have a filter for the activity of other neurons, or this could be an external input, and you have a filter of your own preceding history. This is a way of putting into the model some information about the biophysics of that neuron. What are the statistics of firing of that neuron without writing down a real cellular model with ion channels or anything like that? You add them all up, because this is a linear part of the model, and you pass them through this nonlinearity, which is exponential. And remember, this is not an arbitrary choice. After I said Poisson, this has to be exponential. And the same thing for neuron B. Neuron B also has a self-kernel. This is the autoregressive kernel of neuron B. And this is the kernel through which the spikes from neuron A are being filtered. So this is the alpha BB, and this is the alpha BA, and you pass them through an exponential. So there are two things you can do. You can actually use data to determine these filters, but once you have determined these filters, this becomes a generative model. You know, it's a model that generates spikes, because once you have the Poisson variable, then you just generate spikes according to that distribution. So you generate spikes, and these coefficients, these kernels, are giving you a network reconstruction in the sense that if you've done the job correctly, the spikes that you generate have the same statistics as the spikes that you use to feed the parameters in the model. So I have a generative model, I have a network of 100 neurons that behave as the 100 neurons that I was recording from. Which is not to say that this is the way those 100 neurons were connected to each other, because there's a lot of polysynaptic paths that involve other neurons that I'm not monitoring, so I cannot put them into the model. And this is, yeah? Yeah, so the self-coupling, you'll see the self-couplings. This is a typical example. This is a little toy model that we did. So in this typical example, first of all, if you look at the diagonal, you have the self-couplings. And the self-couplings typically have this big refractory component, which is telling you that after the neuron fire, it's unlikely to fire. And whether it does or does not have this refractoriness is followed by a facilitation has to do whether this neuron has a typical interspike interval or not by itself. And then, of course, when we solve this problem, we can regularize it. We can make sure that this kernels are continuous, and we do that using a very nice idea introduced by Jonathan Pillow. And we can also try to make this network of coupling, of connectivity kernels, as sparse as possible. And we do that, actually, we do that. Other people do it differently, but we do that using a very old idea that I had proposed when I was working in neural networks together with Jan LeCun and John Denker, that at that time we called optimal brain damage. And the idea was how to prune a network so that the network is as small as possible, but it does the job. And here it's the same idea. You know, how many of these coefficients can I set equal to zero and still get a good statistical reproduction of the spikes, so that I can find the less connected network that explains the data. And in this case, you see, for instance, from the purple neuron has a self-kernel, but it's not talking to the blue or the green or the red. So there is no outgoing arrows from the purple neuron. And you can, this is the connectivity diagram. And then, of course, I can associate a strength with each one of these parameters if I want to by simply looking at the area under the curve. But the area, I don't want the cancellation, so what I do is I sum the absolute value of the alpha ij's over m to get a measure for how much these kernels deviate from being flat at zero. Yeah. Which constraints? The minimal number of kernels. So what I do is the following, and again, there are different ideas on how to do this. I determine the salience of each kernel, and the salience is defined by the magnitude of the kernel multiplied by the diagonal element of the second derivative. Because the idea is that some people think, okay, you just cut off the ones that have small magnitude. But the idea is I'm trying to maximize the likelihood function. So this is the likelihood function as a function of one of my parameters, one of my alphas. And it has a maximum. So this was the value that I determined from my optimization. If I'm going to cut it, what I want to know is where this intersection is. Because if I'm going to set it equal to zero, this is what I'm going to lose in maximum likelihood. And what I'm going to lose is no first derivative contribution because I'm at the maximum, is the second derivative times d squared. and that defines the saliency of the parameter. So you, and it's nice because it only involves the diagonal element of the Hessian. So you take all your parameters, you compute the salience of all of them, you order them according to saliency, you cut the one that has lowest saliency, and you retrain, because now in this, you've lost one dimension in your parameter space, and now there is another optimal, which is not necessarily where you are. So, and then repeat. So it's a very good way of doing the network regularization. The continuity is enforced by a very nice idea of Jonathan Pillow that that works beautifully. Okay. The very nice idea about this functional connectivity, and this is again a place where we have had a long, long fight in publishing with biologists, is that how is this different from correlations? Why, you know, I have all this data, why don't I look at pairwise correlations and give you the nice correlation coefficients as a function of time, and what do I gain by doing this? And what I gain by doing this is that this approach, because it doesn't solve the problem in a pairwise manner, it solves the problem globally, looking at all the spikes of all the neurons simultaneously, gives me solutions that are different from the one that I will find in correlation. So for instance, imagine that A talks to B and B talks to C. So if I look at the pairwise correlations, not only I will see, of course, the correlation going from A to B and the correlation going from B to C, but I will also see a correlation between A and C if I simply look at correlations. But if I do the functional connectivity, and here can you see what you were talking about, the diagonal kernels just only showed refractoriness, right? The diagonal kernels, A to A, B to B, C to C, only show this suppression. But now I see that A excites B, B excites C, but A doesn't talk to C at all. I get that from doing the kernel treatment. Or the same case in which there are correlations between B and C because they have a common input. They have a common input, but they are not connected in any way. And again, if you simply look at the correlations, you will see, of course, A has a correlation between B and C, but there is also, A correlates to B and correlates to C, but there's also a correlation between B and C that when you do this treatment, you get rid of, because you're looking at all the spikes simultaneously. So you're not solving pairwise problems, you're solving a global problem in this case. So that's what you get actually from the simulations based on this spiking data. So it is more powerful than pairwise correlations, and it allows us to do network reconstruction.
But there is a lot of using this term functional connectivity, which I know is being used a lot in the MRI community. Do they use it in the same way, or do they use it in the general MRI model, or do they talk about functional correlations?
In the fMRI community, they tend to do this Granger causality. And it's because these networks have very few quote-unquote neurons, not neurons, but zones or areas. They are just looking at connectivity between areas of the brain. And for some reason, you know, they read these papers on Granger causality and they liked it and they applied it. If you try to apply Granger causality to of the order of 100 degrees of freedom, you can't do it. While here, you know, I have a method that has a single maximum, I do gradient ascent, I find a maximum, there is no ambiguity, it doesn't get worse as you increase the number of parameters. Yeah, Fred, you had a comment? They call it what? If you give me a good name, I will love it. I mean, we call it functional connectivity because that's the term that was introduced when people start doing point processes. You know, there is the first paper is a paper by Emery Brown and Otakan and somebody else whose name I don't remember. It's a neural computation paper in 2000 or 2002, which is where they were really were looking at point processes. So in their case, the bin has to be small enough so that there's only zero spikes or at most one spike. So the variable is a binary variable. And in this case, you can do the same thing, but the nonlinearity has to be a logistic function instead of being an exponential function. And then you get the, you know, the sigmoidal that we...
So.
Okay, if you... I'm happy to change it. Just give me a suggestion and I'll change it. I'm just following a notation in this particular field, but I'm happy to change it because it always causes problems. And it goes back to this question whether this is or is not a synaptic connection. And what do I mean by functional? It's not anatomical, but is it functional? Does it mean that there is a synapse between these two neurons that is acting in time as you as your kernel? So I am happy to drop it. Just give me an alternative.
The other thing I know that I'm not clear about. some of the dynamics of the network could be because they're receiving different external inputs rather than because of how they're talking to each other.
That's fine. You just, if you know what it is.
Yeah, but if you don't know.
If you don't know, I can't put in what I don't know. It's a fair model. You can put in everything that you know.
So you're saying all the dynamics have to come from the internal?
No, it doesn't have to come from the internal. I can put external covariates, yeah, but I have to put them in all the neurons at the same time unless I know that they affect different neurons differently. For instance, when I do models like this for the center out task, I know from the Georgopoulos idea that the neurons have individual cosine tunings with individual biases and individual preferred directions, so I can put it in if I have independently measured the preferred directions of the neurons. Then I can solve the problem and I can ask to which extent is the activity of the neurons explained purely by how they covary with the external task. Are they a real cosine-tuned Georgopoulos neurons only, or do I have to take into account the fact that they are also connected to each other and it's a network that underlies the task? And in that case, it's very interesting, actually, because Georgopoulos will give you the prediction in the center out task. If all the neurons were simply cosine-tuned to the external motion, all the activity would have to live in a two-dimensional subspace, which is flat. Actually, when you analyze the data, there is a two-dimensional subspace, but it's not flat, it's a manifold. And then you can show that the curvature is a property of the network, that because of interactions between the neurons, the manifold has to be curved. And in that curved manifold, you superimpose the Georgopoulos idea of cosine-tuned neurons. So if you know something, you can put it in. And in this case, the external task would modulate different neurons differently because I know the preferred direction from all the neurons, so I can put it in the model.
You put in a functional form of that tuning and be inferring the tuning.
And you would be inferring the coefficient that tells you how the activity of this neuron at time t is going to be affected by the fact that at time now t plus m, not t minus m, I'm going to be moving. And then you can ask, what matters? Does it matter the position in which I am at time t plus m? What matters is the velocity that I have at time t plus m? Or what matters is what's my final destination regardless of the variability in velocity? So you can begin to answer things that are also controversial in the motor control area, which is, are these neurons tuning for position, are they tuning for velocity, are they tuning for endpoint? We use data where the muscles are also measured, so I can ask what is more predictive of what the neuron will do, the muscle activity or where the arm is going to be. So are the motor neurons, the neurons in primary motor cortex coding for muscle activity or coding for movement parameters? So it's a very flexible approach, but you can put in everything that you measure, but you cannot put in anything that you don't measure. And I think that's a very fair way of approaching the problem. You know, it's really data driven. Spatial? Yeah. So imagine that you knew that some neurons, that there is some kernel that modulates spatially the interaction between neurons. I could put it in by modulating the function alpha ij according to the actual physical distance, if you think that's important. In motor cortex, it's not important because it's a little bit like HVC. It's not spatially organized. So all the neurons that control a given part are not close to each other. They are not clustered. There is a big map in motor cortex, a homunculus. So you know that there is an arm area and a leg area. But within the arm area, they are not, it's not like all the neurons that have a given preferred direction are clustered together. So if I'm looking, for instance, for this Georgopoulos type idea, the spatial organization of the neurons is not very important. But if it's important, you could put it in. And if you know it, because you know, of course, the spatial organization of the electrodes, and you know from which electrode you were recording every neuron, you can put that in as a modulation, as an IJ-dependent modulation in the alpha IJ. I haven't tried that, but it can be done within this approach. Okay, so let me go back to the ground truth. So we were intrigued by this idea of the ground truth. So what we did is we constructed, so I'll show you now very quickly a simulation environment, and then I'll show you application to real data. So in the simulation environment, we created a network of 10,000 neurons. They are Itsikievich neurons, and they are so that they are not connected according to this GLM model. So the activity is generated by a model that doesn't know about GLMs, doesn't know about generalized linear models, right? So they're Itsikievich neurons, and then we take six of them, we draw them at random, And we ask, what can we say about the interactions between these six neurons if we try to reconstruct it from their activity? And we do this 80 times by drawing six neurons at random in different ways. So this is the real network. So we look at the network, and this is the way these six neurons were connected. And I'm sorry for all these connections from, but connections to, but for some reason, some biologists have trouble with alpha ij going from j to I instead of from I to j. So I'm used to putting this connection from to, you know, from along the columns and to along the rows. I know you don't need that. So this is the actual, this is a reconstruction. And the R-squared is not very good, again, for the reasons we were discussing before, because I'm just looking at the activity of six neurons, and I'm trying to reconstruct their underlying alpha ij structure. But of course, there is a lot of correlations and influence of each other through all the other 10,000 minus six neurons that I'm not monitoring. So if you look at the R-squared, in this case was 0.5, and this is the distribution of R-squares when we did this 80 times. You get sometimes a good R-square, sometimes a low, but the median R-square is 0.6. It's not very good. Say it again? How many connections per neuron? We had to connect them a bit more than you would do in as a connectivity fraction, so that the network would be able to sustain activity, actually. So our connectivity was that every neuron was receiving input from the order of 50 neurons, which is higher than, you know, 50 out of 10,000 is higher, of course, than 10 to the 4 out of a million. So you say, well, this is not great tool, but this is what the tool is great for in this particular case that we were interested in, is that if I ask, can I reconstruct the W's? This is the same plot I showed you before. I don't do very well. So these are the W's in a color scheme in this WIJ matrix. Again, the WIJs are measured. I get a single number WIJ by measuring the absolute value of the area under the alpha IJ of M curve, just to get how much it deviates from zero. But the interesting thing was that then we went into the simulation environment and we made local changes in the connectivity between some of the neurons. So for instance, here we changed the connection from neuron 4 to neuron 3, and the connection from neuron 2 to neuron 5, and from neuron 2 to neuron 3. These are now the changes in connectivity. So we made a very weak strengthening of these synapses and a very strong weakening of these synapses. And we didn't know what to expect because, again, the measure is a global measure, and we didn't. David, you sound very worried. Within those six neurons, this is in the model. We made this change. But again, these six neurons are connecting to a lot of neurons that are not within those six, that are connecting back within those six. So we didn't know whether this would cause a diffuse change in activity or a concentrated change in activity in these six neurons that we are monitoring. So then we go back, we measure the activity, we do the inferred connectivity, and now we typically get a much higher distribution of R squared. So this is the same plot I showed you before. This is the R squared for the 80 experiments where we are trying to unveil the ground truth. And this is the R squared when we try to determine whether the coefficients had changed or not. And as you see, this is a much higher correlation and it's clustered much higher up, and it's a little bit of correlation that in the cases where we could not predict the ground truth at all, we could not predict the changes either. But in general, once you get into this really low level of predictivity in terms of the weights themselves, we were able to do a very good job of determining the changes in the weights, or which, again, the changes, yeah. I didn't. I didn't do that. It's a good question. It's lower, clearly, yes. but I don't know by how much. That's a good question.
Is it just because it's shallower?
No, it's not very. It's not shallow. It's not shallow. I'll look into that. That's a very good question. Okay, so now let me go to the experiment because this is what I really want to show you, and I'm fine because I'll finish in less than 50 minutes. So our goal was to induce changes in connectivity in vivo. And these experiments were done by Jim Rebesco in the sensory motor cortex of rat in the area that is related to the motion of the forelimbs, the anterior legs. This was a fine while you're recording, this was not the multi-electrode arrays that I showed you earlier, and he was able to separate activities in, depending on the experiment, sometimes 4 neurons, minimum of 4, maximum of 9 neurons. And he did, he implemented a paradigm which is a very much reminiscent of spike time independent plasticity. So one of these electrodes was used as a recording electrode, and one neuron was identified. And every time that that neuron spiked, then a stimulation was implemented in one of the other electrodes at a specific time lag, so that the stimulation pattern, which was a pulse, becomes an exact replica of the spiking train of the trigger neuron. And the target is delivering pulses exactly in that pattern by shifted by an amount, by a delay, a lag that we fix. Okay? And we use 3 values of that lag, 5 milliseconds, 50 milliseconds, and 500 milliseconds. So this is like a spike time independent plasticity experiment. And this is what is happening in the lab. I'll show you the delta W in a moment. And the paradigm was implemented for sometimes 24, sometimes 48 hours. Here is the pattern that I'm showing you. So the rat is not doing anything. There is no particular stimulus. There is no particular action. The rat is just moving around in its little cage. And at the beginning, we don't do anything. And we are monitoring the weight we do. Okay. So the rat is doing nothing. Then for 6 or 12 hours, depending on the paradigm, this stimulation is applied. And then we stop stimulating, and we use both electrodes, both the electrode that records, that has access to the target neuron and the trigger neuron. We use both of them for recording, and of course the other ones for recording also, and we do a network reconstruction. And we look at whether the weight in our network reconstruction algorithm that connects the trigger neuron to the target neuron has increased or decreased or changed. So this is the weight that I'm plotting here, is a change in the weight from the trigger neuron to the target neuron. So you see, before we start our stimulation paradigm, there is a little bit of variation. Then we run the stimulation paradigm for 12 hours. We let the then we do nothing for half an hour except record. And we use that data to reconstruct the network and look at the change in that weight. Then again, after 24 hours, after 36, after 48. So we see this monotonic increase on the strength of the weight of the connectivity from the trigger neuron to the target neuron when we use a latency of 5 milliseconds. And this, you know, persists for between 24 and 48 hours. But is a change in weight. Let me finish this. Let me finish this and I'll take your question. But when we, instead of using a 5 millisecond latency, we use a 500 millisecond latency, so that now the stimulation is lagging the activity of the trigger neuron by 500 milliseconds, then we don't see this increase in the weight. Ken, what was the question? Oh, this is arbitrary neurons, because it's the units of the alpha ijs. So the weight is measured in units of the alpha ijs. It's the kernels that come out from the fitting parameter. I'll show you a meaningful comparison, because I'll show you how these extracted weights fluctuate when we're doing nothing. That will give you a better sense of scale. That comes in the next transparency. Sophie. Here it was applied for 2 days in periods of 12 hours, actually 11 and a half hours. So we applied for 11 and a half hours and we stopped for half an hour to let the rat run around and take data. What is the current state of the network? And in particular, once we reconstruct the network, which is typically 6 or 9 neurons, what is the particular strength of the connection from the trigger neuron to the target neuron, which we know? Yes, except for these intervals of half an hour. Here you see the stimulation rate, okay? So here you see the stimulation. Here we stop to record. Then we stimulate it again, then we stop to record. So this is the stimulation rate. This is plotted at the resolution of 1 minute, actually. So this is how many pulses per minute we deliver to the target neuron. But this is controlled by the activity of the trigger neuron. So because every time the trigger spikes, we apply a stimulation on the target electrode. On the target electrode, which is affecting, you know, several neurons, but in particular, then we record the ones that are closed. And here again, we stop every half hour from the onset of stimulation. And this is, I'll come back to the data that answers your question in the next slide, Ken. But so these are the kernels that we extracted. So in this case, we have the ability to distinguish five neurons, and here we look at all the 5x5 kernels. So the black ones are the kernels that we measured before the stimulation started, and the red ones are the kernels that we extracted from the network reconstruction after the full 24 or 48 hour stimulation paradigm was completed. So you see these interesting kernels. And as a control, I don't know if I put it in. Oh, I didn't, I'm sorry. But we did the same thing with the correlation coefficient, again at the insistence of pestering referee. And we did that, and the correlation coefficients are much more noisy and they don't recover these nice systematic changes. But I also want you to look at the diagonal elements, which are the autokernels, which try to mimic in some sense the biophysics of the spiking statistics of specific neurons. Those don't change very much from initial to final. But there is, in some cases, there isn't much change from pre-stimulation to post-stimulation in the cross kernels either. But in some cases, there is a very clear change due to the stimulation protocol in the cross kernels, in the kernels that go from one neuron to another neuron. So now let me show you something that begins to address the question that Ken asked about, in these units, what's a relevant change. So here again was a case where we were able to monitor five neurons, and here we are trying to connect from neuron 3 to neuron 4 with a 5 millisecond latency, and from neuron 3 to neuron 5 with a 500 millisecond latency. So before we do that, the rat is running around before we start simulation, and we are gathering data, and we can do the network reconstruction between those five neurons before we do anything. And there is natural fluctuations. If we do it, every 10 hours or every 12 hours or every 6 hours, we don't always get the same network. So there are natural fluctuations in these weights. And these are the changes in all the weights. In particular, this is the one that we are going to target later on. So you see that there are changes, but let's say in these units, they are between -2 and 2. These are the random fluctuations of these changes. And here also, between -2 and 2. So now we do the same thing after this stimulation protocol. So now you see following stimulation, this is what the weight matrices look like. This is again this is 5 millisecond latency, this is 500 millisecond latency, and now you can see that this is not very different from what it was from the kind of distribution that it had prior to stimulation. But here, first of all, there is a more general potentiation, and in particular, the trigger target pair that we were targeting is the one that where the changes were larger. So this begins to answer, Ken, your question of what does it mean if I see a change of 10? Well, it has to be compared to this -2 to 2, which is the kind of fluctuations that we see when the rat is running around before we did any prior stimulation. So that's what sets the units of relevance in these weight changes. Yeah. No, the measurement, this is a little bit of an artificial measurement, and it's just a way of trigger spiking statistics. But I think that when they are reflecting the fact that over a period of 6 to 12 hours, depending on which timing we use, we did both, there is a reconfiguration naturally in the network. So there is a drift, and actually, I'm so terrible with names. Robert Ajemian, actually, we were together in a neural control of motion meeting, and I talked about this, and he was very happy because he has a whole theory of natural drifts and how these natural drifts give you an exploration in the network that then makes the network more able to react to important things. And so, yeah. Oh, when we recorded for 30 minutes. But then you can do various things, exactly. So you can use all 30 minutes to do it, or you can do 10, 10, 10, and see, how much fluctuates. So we use, let me tell you in spikes. So that variance between 10, 10, and 10 was comparable to these fluctuations pre-stimulation. So in these arbitrary units, there is this, I went in the wrong direction, sorry. in these arbitrary units is between -2 and 2. Those are the natural fluctuations from the measurement. But when we do this division in 10, 10, and 10 minutes, we get smaller than that. We get of the order of 0.5 to 1 measurement fluctuations. So it's not just, no. But then you could also ask, so, and in number of spikes, we need of the order of 1,000 spikes per neuron to do a reliable estimation of the kernels. That doesn't then vary too much from trial to trial. Yeah. Yes, so I'll talk about that in a moment. As you see, there are many things that got potentiated in addition to the one that I wanted to potentiate. Is that? And the reciprocal one, so I'll talk about that in a moment. Yeah. Yeah.
Would you get a reasonable kernel?
Why didn't I do that? I didn't do that. I was so busy getting this to work that I didn't. That's an excellent control, and I should do it. Absolutely. Absolutely. Matthias, you are totally right, and we'll do it. Yeah. If you shuffle, that's a great question. I haven't done it, and I should have done it, because that's a great control. You're absolutely right. Robert, you had a question, I thought, or Sophie, I thought, I answered your question. Okay. So here again is the difference between going, you know, from the preceding 24 hours to prior to stimulation. So here again, you see the statistics of the weight changes, and these are the blue ones are connections that are not going to be targeted later. The green ones are connections that are going to be targeted at 500 milliseconds, 500 milliseconds delay, and the red one is the connection that is going to be targeted at 5 millisecond delay. And now this is after stimulation, and you see again, as Sophie pointed out, now there is a general potentiation, but yet the effect is much larger for the 5 millisecond than it is for the 500 millisecond, and so there's clearly a potentiation in the network when we do a 5 millisecond delay. And this is a summary of all the rats that the Jim studied. So here are the weight changes. All the red columns are 5 millisecond cases, and the green columns are 500 milliseconds. There were rats where they did both. So there are rats where we use one trigger and two targets. And one target was always stimulated 5 milliseconds after the trigger, and the other target was always stimulated 500 milliseconds after the trigger. So there are cases where we had both columns for the same experiment. There are these three rats. And there were cases where we only did the 5, or we only did the 500, like the other experiments. So this is the weight change compared to the average weight change to get to refer it to this average potentiation effect that took place in some cases. And again, the red dots are the 5 milliseconds, the green dots are the 500 milliseconds, and the ones that are linked vertically are these three, where we simultaneously did from one single target neuron to two trigger, from a single trigger neuron, two targets, one with a 5 millisecond delay and the other one with a 500 millisecond delay. And this is a summary of the changes in the statistics. From targeted to non-targeted. So when we stimulate at 5 milliseconds, there is a targeted effect. There is a potentiation effect even for non-targeted, including the reciprocal connection. But when we did it at 500 milliseconds, this effect was almost non-existent.
Was there a consistent relation between the non-targeted pairs that show potentiation and their prior
No, there wasn't a relation. So we worked a lot trying to understand this. And so this is really not a spike time independent plasticity experiment, of course, because we are stimulating with an electrode. This electrode is going to affect neurons in its vicinity, and it's not a target neuron. You know, it's not like a cage glutamate experiment. But now, after Michael's talk, I realized that we need to do this experiment somehow using the same methods that he was using to try to see if his network was like a Hopfield content addressable memory or not, because this is really the way to do it, is to be able to use one neuron that you record intracellularly as a trigger, and then to be able to stimulate one specific neuron as a target, or differentiate which are the target neurons. So we were doing a different kind of stimulation, although there are some controversies about stimulate diffusively in an area of, you know, like a 10 to 50 microns radio, or do you stimulate in an actual pattern that has to do with the architecture of the network locally? So, but still, you know, it's not a precise stimulation. So it's not a spike timing dependent plasticity experiment. So we have tried to do some modeling using this Bienenstock Moonrock, Cooper Moonrock kind of models, where you try to predict changes based on average firing rates, not so much on the precise timing dependent plasticity. And then we were able to correlate these changes to the autocorrelation pattern of the neuron that we were using as trigger. Now, the neuron that is using as trigger has its own firing pattern, and we are just using it to to trigger then the simulation on the target electrodes. But if we interfere with that neuron in such a way that we manipulate its autocorrelation, then we were able to change the pattern. So we think it doesn't have too much to do with the prior structure of the network, but has to do with the kind of collective activity that is triggered by imposing a temporal pattern of activation on the network as a whole, or that is not sufficiently localized, and that is controlled by the temporal autocorrelation of the pattern of the neuron that we're using as the trigger neuron. Yeah, Raul. They are a bit bigger. They are a bit bigger than these changes here, of the changes in the non-targeted. Some of them are higher than these guys. Some of them are significant, and that's what we were trying to explain. You already asked me this question, and I told you I haven't done it, but I will do it.
But there you had a ground truth, and you also didn't do it for the data.
That's no, I didn't do it. I didn't do it for the data either. Yeah. You cannot do it in the experiment, right? Because to depress the weights, you would have to stimulate in the target electrode before this trigger happens, but I don't know when the trigger neuron is going to fire, so. Yeah, you'd have to be able to stimulate both and impose a negative. Right, actually we expected to see a depression in the reciprocal weight. You know, we had the trigger to target, we expected to see a depression on target to trigger. But then there was this overall potentiation when we were using the 5 millisecond lag, and that effect got washed out in there. Yeah. Right. We don't know how to, because, I mean, essentially, one event, which was not my idea, it was Jim Rebesco's idea, it was our student idea, was that in most cases, so spike time independent plasticity has been studied a lot in vitro. But there are some cases where it has been looked at in vivo, but the way the change in synaptic efficacy has been quantified has been by applying the same kind of stimulus that you use to trigger the synaptic change, and see that the response that you're evoking in the postsynaptic neuron now is bigger if you were potentiating that that synapse. But here we are not using that method at all. We are saying we manipulated the circuit and the network as a whole has changed, and we can, you know, and the rat is just doing its thing. It's not a particular stimulus. We are not stimulating while we are recording. So when we are recording these changes every 6 hours, every 12 hours, it's a change in the firing statistics of the network as a whole. So one thing that we find very interesting about this paradigm is that we demonstrated the ability that we can reorganize circuits on one hand, and on the other hand, we have a tool which is not measuring synaptic connectivity, but it's allowing us to track this network reorganization in a way that is correlated with the manipulation that we used. So it's it's capturing something important about the manipulation that we used, which is actually brings me to my summary, which is that we have used this in vivo activity trigger stimulation, and it induces changes that are consistent with spike time independent plasticity. The changes are detected without invoking changes in the evoked activity of the postsynaptic neuron. And I hope to have convinced you that these generalized neural models are useful for many things. And one of the things that they are useful for is to monitor these changes that have been induced in the quote-unquote network of neurons that we are measuring, which is actually a subnetwork of a much larger network that we are not monitoring. And that's what I wanted to tell you about. So I'm done. Raul. For if I go back to my simulation environment and I create a network of six neurons, and I want to I measure the activity of those six neurons and I want to reconstruct it, that's extremely well. But then I should in that case I should also do Matthias' suggestion, which is to shuffle to alter the temporal order and to see to which extent, how quickly do I destroy the results. But yeah, it's a very, if you're monitoring all degrees of freedom, it's a very effective network reconstruction. But if you have a small network that you are monitoring all degrees of freedom, there are other methods like Granger causality. You know, if you only have six neurons, it would also work. This is why they use it for these networks that Ken was mentioning, networks in fMRI, networks between brain regions, because then the number of nodes is 5 or 6 or 10 at most. So it's a small network in the sense of number of nodes. Yeah.
Do you have intuition of how you misestimate the kernels when the person is happening?
You see, so this is interesting because so there is a Poisson assumption, of course, in the sense of this statistical condition independence. But then I can put in my model for lambda. Here I showed you a very simple example where my model for lambda, for the mean firing rate of the Poisson process as a function of time and for each neuron, only depended on the spiking history of the network up to that point. But as I said before, I can incorporate into the model for lambda all the things that you expect to cause, to modulate or to co-vary in with any time delay that the kernels will tell you about with the actual activity that you observe. So, what was your question? I started talking and then I realized I didn't know which question I was answering. The spike trees don't have to be Poisson-like. So, okay, so in the neurons that we it has to be, right, because the lambda I could change a lot in every time being, but the lambda I could change very dramatically. That's what I was trying to say. Thank you. I got lost in my own argument. The lambda I could change very dramatically from neuron to neuron, and for a given neuron could be very strongly modulated over time. And moreover, in the neurons, Robert, I'm answering your question. So in the neurons that we recorded from, actually, the Fano factor was very close to 1 for all that matters, and the interspike intervals were pretty much Poisson-like. But that's what I was trying to say, and I got lost within myself, that because you can put all these covariates, you can get lambda I's that are very strongly modulated over time. So if you wanted,
yeah.
If it's not Poisson firing, okay. No, but then if it's not Poisson firing, then you tell me what kind of firing it is. If you give me a statistic, so the beautiful of the generalized linear models is that they tell you what is the nonlinearity depending on your assumption, okay? So if it is not Poisson-like, but it is, you're in the 0-1 binary regime, then the nonlinearity should be a logistic function. If it is exponential or gamma, it should be 1 over.
If it,
I haven't thought about it, and I don't even know exactly how to write down that question, because I cannot use what you suggested before, which is to monitor the changes in likelihood, because the likelihood is being computed within the Poisson assumption. So I would have to have a measure that is independent of these Poisson statistics to be able to measure what is the error that comes from making that assumption. And so I haven't done it, and I haven't even thought about it, and I think it's non-trivial to propose a measure that would capture that effect. So it's a good question, but I don't know the answer. Yeah. Fred has decided that the only way he can ask a question is to stand there and be both a member of the audience and the okay.
I think what you put a barrier of something under the
Yeah, it's the area, but not the real area, because the real area could give you a pseudo-Weiss abstraction. So I take the absolute value. So it's the area, but not the area in the sense of an integral, right? No. The alpha ij's come out being what they are. They come out being what they are, and then I define what I get from the algorithm is like this curve. This is the alpha ij. This is the alpha 3-1 as a function of time. Okay, so some of them are positive, some of them are negative. And now what I do is I compute what I call the wij simply because I didn't want to have to compare these kernels. I wanted to have a single number to compare, right? So then I define the wij as a sum over m of the absolute values of the alpha ij of m. Because I didn't want this to be zero if there was an excitation and an inhibition that exactly canceled out. The weights are always positive, but the changes in the weights, which is what I'm monitoring, are not always positive. So this, the weights, the W's that I get from this simple calculation are always positive, but the changes can be positive or negative. Yeah, but the algorithm doesn't give me this, you know, the algorithm gives me this, gives me the kernels, right? Okay, this is just a way that I used to be able to write a matrix like this and put a single scalar in every square, as opposed to have to put a kernel in every square. Yeah, none of these connections was purely inhibitory, except in some cases the diagonal case, which didn't change, as you see. No, I understand your question. Yeah, and I'm not saying that this wij is the optimal measure. You know, what comes out of the calculation of the fit, which is what I trust, is the kernels, and the wij's were just a simple way of having a single scalar to be able to quantify what the connections were. That's all.
It was the same. It was not just a follow-up.
So can he have a follow-up question?
How you calculate the delta W?
I computed the W before and the W after, and that was the delta W.
But you could also take the kernel.
I could also take the difference of the kernels, and we didn't do that, and I can do it, and it's going to be not very dissimilar. But yes, I can do that. So I have several homeworks now, assignments. I have to shuffle, and I have to compute the difference in the maximum likelihood, and I have to compute the difference in the kernels, and then look at that area. Good. Carl, you had a question?
The mean square
difference between the kernels, yeah. Which is essentially that was not your question. What was your question? Of course. No, but this is. I mean to compute the differences. Okay. Yeah.
So we agree that these connections you get are functional, right? But they don't necessarily represent anything.
This.
But you're still making the assumption that they're causal. Right?
So that they are.
Why should we? That they are causal. Your connections are always from.
No, actually, I don't always make this assumption. For instance, I have done models in which I correlate neural activity, of course, with each other because we're measuring simultaneously these 100 neurons in M1, but I also correlate it with motion. And I don't force the kernels to be causal. You know, M could be a variable that could be positive or negative, and you can fit the kernels without forcing them to be causal and ask yourself whether you get an acausal component that is important. Because in some sense, what you're trying to do is, again, these are not real synapses, and you're trying to create a systematic explanation of the statistical properties of the firing patterns that you observe when you record from simultaneously from so many neurons. So if you want, you can impose a causality on the kernels, but you don't have to. And I have actually noticed that not for the spike onto spike, but from spike onto motion, or motion allowing me to explain the spiking activity, I have found that I do slightly, first of all, I have found that velocity is far more important than position in terms of contributing to provide a better explanation of the data in this maximum. There I have compared the maximum likelihood, actually. And but also that the optimal velocity kernels have a slight, a very small tail that goes into the non-causal regime when you feed the data. Yeah. And then again, I mean, should you be bothered by that, or should you, these are not real synapses, these are not real, you know, so it's just telling you that statistically, if you know what the motion is coming from, it gives you a little bit of better ability to predict what the neuron is doing than only looking at the motion that follows the firing activity, which is the causal regime.
But for the spikes,
For the spikes, I have never done it in the non-causal regime. I have always used the previous history to explain. I never allowed these kernels to become non-causal. For historical reasons, because this is what people were doing in the literature when they were just looking at the point process regime. But I could try that and ask the question, does the prediction improve if I allow the kernels to develop a non-causal tail or a non-causal part of the curve? Yeah, it's a good question.
Just a technical question. The reason why most of this kernel doesn't start from zero
In this case, I made these kernels causal. Yeah. So they are, in this case, time in this direction is positive m. It's not a real feature of this. I made these kernels were forced to be causal. Yeah. Exactly. And how much of a non-causal regime do you get, and how much do you improve? That's a good question. Something I can certainly do. There is no longer a generative model, exactly. Which is actually something nice, that it is a generative model, that you can then run it afterwards and get spikes, hopefully with the same statistics. Yeah. Right, so it, you know, the size of the beans depends on what you're trying to explain, right? So here we were using, as you see, these kernels extend of the order of 100 milliseconds. So another good reason why they are not synapses. And here we were using a beaning of 5 milliseconds. Clearly, if I use a bean of 100 milliseconds, I'm not going to get the structure. And as I go to beans of 1 to 2 milliseconds, I will go back to this binary description. We were not particularly interested in the binary description, so we allow for cases where there would be more than one spike per bean. It's a little bit of a question of the temporal resolution on which you want to determine these kernels, right? Yeah, you. But this is something that you choose, you know. So you can do it in different. If for some reason that's what you want to determine, you can do it in different resolutions and compare. You could again compare the maximum likelihood, right? Compare how well you. Although you have to be careful because the maximum likelihood is the error, and as you change these things, then you have more or less parameters in the model. If you make the bean bigger, the number of parameters that I need to go out to 100 milliseconds, the number of parameters in the curve of the kernel becomes smaller. So you have to adjust your maximum likelihood estimate by one of these Akaike criteria or something that takes into account the complexity of the model. You cannot compare just the quality of the fit if a model has significantly different number of parameters than some other model. Okay, thank you.